Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio. Doctor,
so back in December, we covered in the magazine a story about how Warby Parker, often credited with creating the direct-to-consumer craze, was thinking about becoming the Warby Parker of contacts. I feel like, Jason, there's a lot going on in this industry. Our next guest is also looking to expand their company and their reach when it comes to the selling of contacts. In fact, they just did a deal late last year. John Graham is CEO at 1-800-CONTACTS. He's in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio in New York. Welcome to Bloomberg Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. It is interesting. I do feel like, you know, we've seen a lot going on in this space. Tell us a little bit about the deal you did and what's the goal here in terms of kind of becoming larger.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And so 1-800-CONTACTS, we have been around 25 years. This is our 25th year.
Yeah.
And we are the largest seller of contacts in the country. And traditionally, the way that we have fulfilled contacts is that people have their prescription that they get from whatever eye doctor they visit, and then we fulfill that kind of like a pharmacy for contacts. And in the last couple of years, we have started to lean more into the telehealth solutions that are out there so that people, rather than going to the doctor can come through them to them through technology. And so we have a product that we call Express Exam, where someone can just go online, do an exam, and be able to buy their contacts. And the acquisition that we made late last year is a company called 6over6. 6over6 means 2020 outside of the U.S., 6 meters. And so the idea is to continue to advance that telemedicine solution. They have a technology that will allow you to actually do an eye exam with just your iPhone or just your smartphone.
And so, John, you know, in some ways you were direct-to-consumer before direct-to-consumer was cool or people even knew that term. Help us understand where we are in that regard, how far it's advanced, because what you're talking about, and I believe what we've all been talking about as it relates to the vision business especially, is this notion that you really can do a lot of things that maybe didn't seem possible a while ago. It sounds like that is what you're describing.
Yeah, that's a very observant of you, because that's why we're named after a phone number, right? That we were founded just a few years before the internet even got going. So even though we own contacts.com, 1-800-CONTACTS.com, many different URLs, we've always kept the brand 1-800-CONTACTS because of the recall that consumers have for that brand. And so we've gone through the entire shift from phone to the web, and now we're going from the shift from the web back to the phone as everything's back on the phone again. So we've kind of seen this whole thing come full circle, right? And the technology that people carry around in their pockets is more than you had an optometrist's office in the past, or that you had on the Apollo 13 or whatever. And so this technology is really creating disruptive opportunities in business.
I do think, you know, healthcare is certainly one of the industries that we talk about, John, increasingly that has yet to be disrupted, and telemedicine is certainly a big step in that direction. How complicated, though, is it with contacts? I think folks say that you really, you know, they're a little concerned about maybe getting the wrong prescription or things going wrong, and you're talking about your eyes where things can be, you know, pretty serious. So tell us a little bit about any of the pitfalls that you guys have found in kind of going through this process.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. Our industry is this funny intersection between healthcare and consumer, right? There's a lot of consumerism because most of it is self-paid. And for the most part, it is a pretty straightforward process of getting your eyes checked and getting you into contacts or glasses. But they are a medical device, and so you want to be careful that you're wearing the right contacts. And so there's still a doctor involved. It isn't taking the doctor out of healthcare. It's just changing the location of the doctor. So instead of you going to the doctor comes to you through technology. And so for most of our customers, our customers tend to be people that have been in contacts for 10 years, 15 years, same contact, same prescription.
Right.
And they just want to renew that. And so it just simplifies that
and
expands access.
The majority of your customers are
the
that,
majority
right?
of our contacts. Yeah. So this is, at this point, the telemedicine is much more about extending someone's prescription and someone's wearing experience than bringing someone into the category, right? For that 13-year-old just getting into contacts, that's really not what this is targeted at this point.
And so how much do you worry about a Warby or others getting into this and encroaching on your market?
Well, you know, we've always looked at our primary struggle is to move people from a traditional experience into a 21st century experience, to create disruption, to create innovation. And so for the most part, I think of my primary competition as brick and mortar, as independent optometrists, and not just gaining share of other online players. And so having more people disrupting and innovating in vision care is actually a really good thing. I think it's an industry that's been very slow to change, and having a little bit of innovation in the space is not a bad thing from our perspective.
Just quickly, got about 20 seconds. What kind of growth have you guys seen in the last year or so?
The last year has been really good for us, both overall growth in our contact lenses, but growth in these express exams. And then it's doing really well for our bottom line as
double
well.
Double digit growth?
Yeah, double digit.
High teens?
Uh-huh.
Or?
No, we're in double digits, which in an industry is only going 3 or 4%. You know, we're growing probably 3 or 4 times what the industry is.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. John Graham sticking around with the CEO of 1-800-CONTACTS here in New York City with us. And John, I got to ask you, you know, we sort of ended our last piece of the conversation talking about direct to consumer, but talk to us about the consumer's overall willingness to engage on an app, on a phone, because you've really seen the evolution of this in many ways. Is this sort of where we're going? Because I think about my own behavior, and I'm an old guy, and yet I'm very comfortable doing lots of stuff on my phone or online and with all these direct-to-consumer brands.
I think that's right. And you know, people like you and I, we've been through enough to see how many times we've said, well, I would never.
Yes.
And then suddenly it happens, right? I remember the first time buying shoes from Zappos and thinking, but you got to try them on, right? And the first time I used Uber and thinking, I'm going to get in some stranger's car. And so all these things go from disbelief to belief to just the norm. And I think that's what you see happening, right? For the people that are starting to use this, they think, well, why did I ever do that the old way?
Right.
What's the future? I think about, you know, companies, you know, trying to debate public versus private markets, staying private versus going public. What's the future for you guys? Just got about 45 seconds.
So we have been private equity owned four different times now, or three different times, but we've been sold three different times in the last 5 or 10 years. And I think private has been really good for us,
but
public makes sense as well. I think at each 5-year period or whatever, you relook at what the right ownership is and you do what's right for the business and right for the customers.
More deals coming, you think?
Well, we're 4 years into a private equity hold, so I would think so at some point, not too long from now.
Yeah. Do you wear contacts?
I don't. I'm old enough that I wear glasses to read, but I've never worn contacts.
Yeah, I'm the same. I don't wear contacts, but I've gotten to the point where I need glasses for distance. I have not gotten into the...
We're a business that's about 70% women, because, and I am sort of the classic male in our business, where I, even though I don't wear contacts, I've tried to, but I can't give them my eye.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
John Graham, thank you so much. Fun to get some time with you. He's CEO at 1-800-CONTACTS, based in Utah, in our New York studio.
All right, so one of your must-reads when you pick up this current edition of Bloomberg Business Week is all about Forever 21, locked in a high-stakes stare-down with creditors. That's the headline that's on the Bloomberg Terminal. It's available on the terminal and Bloomberg.com as well as in the magazine. Let's hear more about Forever 21 from Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. And Susan Burfield, projects and investigations reporter for Bloomberg Business Week. She co-wrote the story, the lead byline. She joins us on the phone from New York. Susan, I want to start with you. Remind us who Forever 21 is.
Sure. So Forever 21 is really one of the first American fast fashion companies, started in Los Angeles by the Changs, and spread all around the world, selling super cheap fashion to mostly teenagers.
And the Changs are a South Korean couple that are a little bit of an enigma, Susan.
Yeah. So, the Changs moved to Los Angeles from South Korea, as you said. They started this company, and they have remained a private company, very secretive. The family itself owns 99% of the company, and the other 1% is owned by another couple, also Korean-American, who are close friends with them and have been involved in the company since 2000. So it's a hard company to understand from the outside. We were able to talk to a lot of former employees and executives, people who had been in the industry with them. But, you know, just to point out how secretive they are, you know, none of them could speak on the record with us. They were concerned in part about their relationship with the Changs, and also many of them have been forced to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
Now, the whole reason that Forever 21 is noteworthy and newsworthy, Susan, is the fact that it went bankrupt in the fall.
It
also speaks to the precarious business model here, where, you know, they're in malls for the most part around the world. They have huge footprints in malls. And for malls, that's a big thing, because this is one of the reasons that, you know, kids come hang out at malls still. And yet, as the company's gone bankrupt, it's also put some tension on A, the Changs, and B, the creditors, to make sure that the business might actually end up in a position that it can, you know, have a chance at success. Where does everything stand currently now that we're on the other side of the holidays?
Yeah, so, well, the holidays were not good for Forever 21. They, as you said, they filed for bankruptcy in the fall. They've been closing stores in the U.S. and around the world. You know, they've just pulled out almost entirely from Asia, from Latin America. They had, as you said, you know, great real estate, expensive real estate, really big stores. And the concern among the mall owners, you know, is that Forever 21 is, you know, obviously not the only big store that's been closing, but it's become, you know, exceedingly important to mall owners for that exact reason. So they don't want Forever 21. No one wants Forever 21 to go out of business altogether. So they've been negotiating in part to lower rents, you know, to allow the company to survive longer. And then also we reported that there were some early talks about the landlords even taking a stake in the company itself.
I have to say, it's a great retail story, business story, but I have to say, Susan, I love kind of the culture that you get into at the company. You talk about some executives who worked with Mr. Chang for years don't recall him ever stopping by their office or sending an email. Mrs. Chang's section of the building was off limits to anyone who didn't report to her. Former execs saying she wouldn't even let visiting bankers walk down the hallways. One recalls a procurement meeting at which someone took a photo of any supplier who spoke up. This was a strange world.
It was a very strange world. You know, it was, for all of its kind of international expansion, it was still very closed, you know, and even at the height when it was operating in five continents, most everything, all the decisions were made in the Los Angeles headquarters and made by very few people, you know, and what we determined is really part of their problem was that, you know, they expanded so quickly and they really didn't have the managerial expertise to manage that. And it seems like the Changs didn't trust other people to do it for them.
So I'll take issue with one word there, which is expertise, because yeah, it doesn't seem like there was much of that going around. One of my favorite details that you guys had here was like the amount of inventory that was stacking up in places where that inventory was basically unnecessary. What are some examples along those lines that you guys got in your reporting?
Yeah. So, you know, what we found is that, you know, the chains had success early on, and then they expanded, and they never changed the way that they operated. So even though they could, they had available to them, you know, information about sales, but they didn't seem to really take it, take it and use it. So,
make informed decisions.
Yeah. They, you know, they ordered for every store in the world, you know, at the same time, the same kind of products. Clearly, when you're operating, you know, different climates, different seasons, different tastes, different cultural norms, that's not going to work. So they ended up with, you know, clothes that they couldn't sell. We heard that stores kind of on their own were sending inventory, you know, from one place to another. You know, sometimes they had to stack boxes in the dressing rooms because they received too much. Then they would send it back to the distribution center. There just didn't seem to be a great operational system in place. And, you know, what we also kind of determined is that that has made it hard for them to find, you know, potential investors because no one's quite sure really what they've got there.
Right. Right. Well, it's a terrific story. We really appreciate the good reporting. You spending some time with us this afternoon. Susan Burfield, Projects and Investigations reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek. She joined us on the phone from New York City.
It's also just a case, and I know Susan puts this in the story, right? Fast fashion is going out of fashion.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Joel.
And that's the big reckoning, right?
Yeah.
There's multiple reckonings here. It's the mall. It's the business model. It's it's the fact that this thing that, you know, came around 10 years ago is now also feeling like it's on the on its way out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we look around even New York City, and we see these fast fashion houses. I mean, one downstairs from us, you know, H&M was in our building and now closed. And you know, go up and down the main shopping thoroughfares, you just don't see quite as many of them.
Great story. Check it out. It's in the magazine. It's on the Bloomberg Terminal, and it's at Bloomberg.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
Davos, It's happening. The World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland. All the private jets were pointed there. 119 billionaires
ironically,
in attendance.
Don't you think with the theme being climate change?
But I was reading something over the weekend about how, you know, there's like a green fuel or some green option that the private jets are using, which I was like, really?
The cooking fuel, maybe, perhaps? Vegetable oil?
Who knows?
I don't know. All right. So they're all there, thinkers, academics, activists, celebrities, and more. Also there is BlackRock CEO Larry Fink. He's talking
about all of the above.
He really is, actually. Well done.
Thinker, executive,
celebrity. I guess so.
At least to some.
All right. So he's talking about climate change. He's talking specifically, Jason, about the role and responsibilities of companies to help deal with that issue. We talk about climate change all the time. It feels like, though, now that it's also seen as an investment risk, it's caught the world's attention. So let's listen to Larry Fink from Davos. He spoke with Bloomberg News editor-in-chief John Micklethwaite about the responsibility of it.
This year, it was a confluence of many different inputs that I had from our clients. Clients worldwide have been asking me repeatedly more and more and more about how should they frame a portfolio with climate change considerations. And it was very clear to me that this is becoming a dominant theme in with more and more of our investors. We should not avoid the conversation about climate change, because climate change is now becoming an investment risk. And no differently as investors focus on yield curve or whatever forms of risk we have, it was very clear to me now we need to now bring forward better risk tools to navigate risk. And this is a component of the letter, was asking more companies to be more self-reporting on things like SASB and TCFD, so we have better clarity in understanding how each company is navigating these issues. The key that we need to do is try to find ways of mitigating those risks while we are dependent on carbon recapture. There are many things we need to be doing. But my greatest concern is not that we as investors and we the capital markets are not going to find a lot of capital to invest in these projects. My biggest fear is the dependability and the dependency we have on governments. Because I don't see governments are working towards these long-term objectives. Climate change is not going to be fixed by a central bank. And it's going to be fixed by a combination of public and private.
And that is Larry Fink, the chairman and CEO, co-founder of BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, speaking in Davos to John Micklethwaite.
I think this is really important. And I do find it fascinating that now that there are financial implications to all of this, right, companies are going to be impacted. They already are, whether you're an insurance company, whether you're a builder, you're impacted by climate change potentially. And so this has kind of awakened the financial world, if you will. But, you know, what's interesting is Fink went on to say, Jason, that climate change will be a disruptive force that could have social implications. And I do think about those households that get caught, they're often in those lower lying areas, right, in terms of land and development. And I know communities are starting to work on that to actually buy up those homes at market price to get people moved out of there, because there's a cost to the municipalities. But you think about those people who are exposed, you know, they're not going to be able to maybe afford the rising insurance costs or the loss of a home. And so I feel like those greater gaps and inequalities that we already see in society can be exacerbated.
Well, and it also, to me, raises the question, and I believe Fink talked about this a little bit too, of whose responsibility is it? You know, I mean,
everybody's responsible, actually.
It is, but is there more responsibility that should be placed on massive shareholders in the case of BlackRock? And, you know, we talked about this with Annie Moss's cover story about the big three, right?
Well, and think about, the amount of money that they hold in those index funds, in some, you know, when it comes to certain stocks, it's like 20, almost 30%. So they can really be a force for change for good if they decide to be. Well, it's interesting because remember we talked about BlackRock specifically talking about incorporating sustainability into its investment processes, but it was for their active funds. Right. And they've got about $5 trillion in their passive funds.
Right.
So it's kind of like,
you're getting there. It's like, okay, you're going in the right direction. But listen, it is not something that anybody can do lightly or quickly. And it probably is a situation where were they to really go so far as to say, all right, even our passive holdings, we've got to do that, you would probably see a massive rebalancing, as it were,
absolutely,
to use the argot of the industry, of what they hold, because a lot of companies out there wouldn't pass muster.
Correct.
With a lot of these ESG characteristics. We've got a good story in the magazine about this week.
And meanwhile, TikTok, because the clock continues and the planet
TikTok
gets...
TikTok like the dancing?
No, it's I'm going to be serious. Oh, the planet's getting warmer and warmer. And I don't know, you know, how much we have to see, whether it's the fires in Australia, the fires in California, the floods that we are seeing. You know, look at the world's oceans getting warmer. I mean, I don't know what more evidence we need. I'm sorry, I'm on my soapbox. But
I just wanted to talk about TikTok videos.
I know.
Okay. But now the planet's
serious,
being destroyed.
I'm the serious one. And
yeah, know, I mean, seriously.
Making jokes all the way.
Yeah, just all the way. Just Jokey McJokerson over here.
Go to Bloomberg.com, folks. Check out, because there's lots of great interviews from Davos, including the complete interview.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. D.R. Barton Jr., Chief Technical Strategist for MoneyMorning.com, based in Delaware, back with us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio in New York. Welcome back.
Well, Carol and Jason, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. So when you look at this market environment, I don't know, what does it say to you about visibility and kind of where we might be going from here?
You know, the theme that keeps coming back for me, Carol, is resilience. I mean, we get bad news and the market pops. We get, it drops down just for a short time, and then it pops back, regardless of what it's been the last few weeks. And you know, this morning we all got the news. I was actually watching on the monitors last night when the news of the coronavirus being more widespread,
right,
than originally thought. And the Dow dropped 100 points in a matter of seconds on that news. And if people with some good market memory might remember all the way back to SARS and what that did to the markets, but remember the Ebola problems and the real issues when that second Ebola case hit the U.S. in October of 2014, the markets were down about 6% in 2 days. So wow, this is a real issue, because it's a lot of resources that people would have to put toward making sure we're already doing it. We're already doing extra screens at airports and mm-hmm. things just already.
I remember rethinking doing some traveling at that time and being nervous about it because of it,
you know,
and potentially holding back.
I had half a plane to myself when I went over to Singapore in just after, right at the tail end of the SARS scare. And I paid $700 for a round trip ticket to Singapore to see a business colleague. And it was like a ghost town on that plane.
And so at what point do you start to worry? So we have a U.S. case, a confirmed U.S. case, according to the CDC. At what point does this really start to impact the markets in the magnitude that you just described that we had with SARS?
Yeah, well Ebola, and Ebola, more recently in our memory, it was a very contagious disease. And, you know, up until yesterday, we didn't think, the medical officials in China didn't think it was human to human transmitted, only animal to human. And then they got that one case that made 14 people sick in a hospital. So I think it's when we would see a spread, when we would see someone else infect a second party in the U.S., not a second case coming in. That's when people will start going, this is really something to pay attention to. But I think the flipping back, Jason, what I'm seeing is with that happening, our markets just really aren't responding that badly. I mean, if you look at the ETF, the China ETF, the FXI, the large cap ETF, it's down 4.5% today. So there's some real concern about handling of that. And there is some history that they did not disclose the SARS, the breadth of the SARS issue until much too late
well,
the last time around.
It makes sense to see the bigger impact over in Asia, right? Because they're closest to what's happening. But I will say, and we watched it as the news broke and the headline broke of the case, you know, here in the United States, markets took a leg down we're off our lows, but nonetheless, it was sharp and swift, and we definitely did take a leg down. So it's certainly a situation that bears watching to see if it becomes more widespread, and hopefully it does not. So when you look at some of the other things that guide your investment decisions right now, what's the top two?
Yeah, I think the top two are really big picture. I got to go up to the 30,000 foot view to talk about central bank supportiveness. And that money that's flowing into the banking system is then going to go somewhere where it's treated best. And it's still being treated best right here in the U.S. stock markets. And in the U.S. stock markets at those huge mega tech companies that we talk about all the time that are doing double digit revenue growth, despite being the world's biggest companies. So that flow is going to continue. And I think that everything else is an interruption in between. And the second thing, Carol, is that I see the support, that it's not just a few of the big dogs pulling the sled. When we look at breadth numbers, the number of stocks that are participating,
how broad-based
in
the rally is.
The rally is very broad-based. On Friday, we had 35 times more stocks hit a new 52-week high than hit a new 52-week low, like 730 to 30 something. So it's a lot of stocks participating, and that lets me know that there are more legs to this up move.
And so, what then do you worry about the most longer term? I mean, I think about even what we've been dealing with today with impeachment, mm-hmm. and obviously North Korea is still hanging out there. You have the president in Davos, and you know, we've got talk about climate change. We just did a segment, you know, with our expert on that. And I do just wonder what disruption is out there that we're not thinking about. And I feel like we're talking about it, especially because we didn't see this virus coming.
Sure. And I think on the short term, the things that we might watch are obviously more on the virus issue. But if something were to, for a broad market participants and the traders and investors I talk to, if something were to disturb the phase two China deal, if we had Hong Kong protests rear their head again, and U.S. felt like it had to get involved and therefore put some wedge into that process for the phase two deal, or if China is found not following through on the IP protection that they're supposed to be doing, or the U.S. does something on their side that they're not doing something that they agreed to, I think that's the biggest near-term worry. There's always profit taking, and we're due for a little leg down, and if we do, I'm going to rejoice because I'm going to be buying it. But I think for big things, I think those are the things that I'm looking at short term. Sure, Korea could go off at any moment and shoot another missile, and then we would, you know, have some near short-term disturbance as well.
DR, just got about 30 seconds left here. So somebody who's got some new money to commit to this market, where do you put it?
Yeah, and I think that's going to be a lot risk-based. I mean, I think that if, you know, one of the stocks that I've been liking and I own and I recommend, I think Amazon has trailed the other big mega techs, but I think they're going to have an up leg and play a little catch-up in the first half. And if you're a little more risk-averse, I really like the utilities for early with this low interest rate environment. I like Southern Company in particular. I think they're doing a great job executing.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. Great to catch up with you. D.R. Barton Jr., Chief Technical Strategist for MoneyMorning.com, based down in Delaware, here with us in New York City today. Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.